Welcome to the You Catastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I am Joel, he's Dave. Last week, we went all moralistic on you. We put on our scolding shoes, pants, and scolding glasses, and we walked through C.S. Lewis a little bit on the inner ring. So I thought this week, we better get back to some fundamentals, which is why I'm going to open with this question for David. Why do you hate Star Trek?
It's not so much that I hate it. It's that it's always trying to push on its liberal agenda. No.
Go on.
I don't hate it. It's just I didn't have access to it as a kid. Like, I watched it. Like, it was always on in the middle of the night as a kid.
It was too sciencey for you and just like kind of...
Yeah, it was a bit like that, actually. Not sciencey, but it was just incredibly... It's certainly not like a Star Wars, for example. It's very kind of low-key, I suppose is what you'd call it. And it's very cerebral. So it's all about solving a problem using words and not explosions.
Yeah.
Unless...
What was that movie you watched the other day you were saying? It was just so sick because the guy had guns and his guns had guns. Extraction. And then they find lasers out of the guns and the lasers had bees.
Yeah. But so I think I found it impenetrable as a kid a little bit. But I watched all the films and enjoyed them. I remember one of the things that scared the hell out of me the most as a kid is is it Star Trek 2 where the earworms go in their heads?
I don't remember. I don't remember. There's an episode of Next Generation where they have these weird parasitic things invade various members of the Federation.
Yeah, right.
And then Riker and Picard turn their phases to explode and they just explode these heads. We never see anything like that again in Star Trek.
No, this is one of the films. It's Bones gets an earworm put in him, and it's real gross. Yeah, so that I don't necessarily. I watched the only series that I really watched through was Deep Space Nine, and I quite enjoyed that.
Yeah, Deep Space. Yeah, it's great. It's interesting you don't like it because you know it makes you a bad person who's wrong in the heart, but. Also because Star Trek is just allegory, you know, and you're like all about Lewis and this last
for,
week.
For
and
a, so post, for Star a Trek- post-God communist society.
Well, actually, that's fascinating because you can track sort of discourses of secularization through Star Trek, right? Through TNG, there is this kind of rationalistic humanism. So you get all these speeches from Picard, who I love, but you get all these speeches from Picard where basically he's like, we are humans and we are rational and we are this. And we've reached the point of just pure humanity's reasonableness. But then actually, by the time you get to Voyager, it is much more sort of attentive to the idea that there may be mystery, the idea that there may be God. And so you get characters there who are actually much more enmeshed in their own sort of traditional spiritualities and so on, right? Like much more, and also you get it in Deep Space Nine even, much more emphasis on Klingon ritual and things like this, right? So there's a kind of this resurgence of this discourse of religion.
And the wormhole, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
anyway, we should probably get on.
No, because there's an episode in TNG, right, where all the races come together and they discover that they've all been seeded by this other race. So there's no mystery to, there's no notion there of a creator. It's just,
have I spoiled June for you?
Yeah, no, thanks. Really appreciate it. I'm going to tell you about the Rainwilds Chronicles now and like, and all Robin Hobb. And I'm going to spoil Harry Potter for Dave because he's been reading it for the past 20 years. Still hasn't finished. Still, you'll get there. You're the little engine that could. Anyway, what we're actually discussing is not related to Star Trek. It's that very, very different thing called Star Wars. And this is basically a lament. You will have remembered that we went and saw Rise of Skywalker and we came back and we said we were going to give an episode on it and we didn't because we're just too
hurt. Silence was deafening.
Silence is just, it expressed our heart song's pain. So much pain that we had to wait a little while before we could really come to terms with that without breaking into tears at every single step. So this is a lament, essentially. So Star Wars, we want to talk about what has gone wrong with Star Wars and why the ending of Star Wars in Rise of Skywalker is problematic and how that colors then the entire narrative. So Dave basically spoiled my life the other day by saying on this show, he said that it is that Rise of Skywalker retrospectively begins to color and taint his experience of the other components of Star Wars. And I thought, oh, whoa, Dave, that's a bit far. And then I went to go watch some more Star Wars material and I thought, what's the point? What's the point? If all of this leads to Rise of Skywalker, you know, if that is the fundamental end, what's the point? So we've had this long journey since 1977, beginning with A New Hope, and then concluding in 2019 with Rise of Skywalker. There are highs along the way. You know, Ewoks who danced gloriously at the end of Return of the Jedi, or for Dave, you know, the whatever pick of the bunch in Empire Strikes Back that he loves, of course. And then there are deep lows as well. We thought the lowest was, you know, seeing Jar Jar Binks in episode one, right? We thought that may be the lowest point. Or what is it? Anakin's, you know, don't you hate sand? It just gets in everywhere, right? Those we thought were low points and yet still part of a continuous narrative arc. But now we've come to Rise of Skywalker and we did an episode on Avengers Endgame. We talked about how there was just such emotional satisfaction in the ending and how, in contrast, you could say, Rise of Skywalker has left us feeling empty, if not generally angry. So I wanted to begin first by just, you know, for those thinking, gosh, these guys are nerding out, the answer is yes, we are. So the question for you, Dave, to begin with is why was, if not is, at least why was Star Wars so foundational, so important to you? You know, this is your personal testimony moment, you know? This is where you get up and tell your story.
Yeah, so this is how I accepted George Lucas as my personal Lord and Savior. Well, it was really like, so I was obsessed with Star Wars as a kid. So people often say, talk about it, that were obsessed with it. I think any actor in the new Star Wars movies was contractually obliged to say that. But I was obsessed with it. I had like all the Expanded Universe books. Like the only books I read as a kid, as a child, were Star Wars novels. I had all...
Which they're not even that good.
Oh, no, there's some good ones. But you know, I had all the action figures. I had encyclopedias and things like that. And I, at my very lowest in primary school, I would use a tape recorder to record lines from the movies to play back to myself. Yeah. But so I was absolutely obsessed.
Did you put on the voices?
Yeah, probably, for sure.
No, it's not true.
But I think it was important for me because I think a big part of it was it really... So I didn't grow up with much religious instruction for the first part of my life. And it really provided a sense of enchantment to the world for me. And it was an incredibly well-realized universe, especially as kind of it expanded through other mediums and things like that, like books and things like that. And you got a sense that there's a whole world that you could enter into. And I think that's one of the brilliant pieces, one of the brilliant things behind, one of the brilliant aspects of the narrative device of the original movies was that it like the first thing you see is episode four and then it gives you like the story so far and you feel like you've come in the middle of a narrative that you've missed out.
A fully realized world.
And that you've missed out on, like you're coming up to speed with something that preceded you. And that's an incredible sense. And it was also important for me like morally as well. So the idea present in Star Wars that evil, once you open the door to evil, that it pulls you in and dominates you and makes you its slave, which is something I think they lose sight of in the prequels a little bit. But the idea that at the heart of evil is a slavishness that you see in Darth Vader, that he's subordinate to the Emperor, he's a slave to the Emperor, and the narrative arc for him is his liberation from his own wickedness. That was an incredibly powerful thing. And the idea that the hero in it comes to identify the darkness of his opponent within himself. And what he's really fighting against is his own shadow. That for someone that didn't have the religious grounding that would provide those kinds of concepts early on, I found that incredibly powerful. Yeah.
And something you see in Ursula Le Guin as well, in her Earthsea Quartet, that the deepest, darkest recesses are the thing inside ourselves as well, our own shadow. But I think it's interesting what you say about the subordination of the person to evil, because I find as well, I actually think the prequels highlight something, even though there's problems, they highlight something really fascinating about evil, namely that it is easy. And it's easy because it entices, so what actually in the end tips Anakin over into evil is his desire for recognition and his desire for life, to maintain life, namely those of who he loves. And this actually becomes, those goods that become not relative anymore, but, seen as an ultimate end, and that tips him into this evil that is ultimately more seductive. And so there's a kind of also element there as well that I love as well, because it's sort of, it shows that good takes work. Good takes effort to continually make the choice to the good or to continually.
And isn't that one of Yoda's sayings is like, if you take the easy path, like when he's on his way in Empire Strikes Back to confront, like to try and rescue his friends, Yoda warns him that part of the things is if you take the easy path.
And then I love it how this is like, this is a cosmic drama that runs through family and person, right? So it's almost this metonymy where it's the individual person reflects also the family, reflects also the cosmos, right? So it's a family soap opera between these Skywalkers that runs through the goodness or the evil running through the heart of, say, Vader and Luke and so on. But it also has cosmic implications, right? That there are some people trying to pursue what is a fundamental good in the universe, whereas others are trying to impose their own sense of order upon it, their own sense of, a discipline and so on, right? That consumes the family, the individual, and the very, foundations of political society or whatever. And again, in the way that evil becomes enchanting. So, the emperor takes over as the emperor because the people see it as a necessity in a time of crisis, right? That totalitarian regime sort of thing. Padme has that very ridiculously on the nose line, about this is how liberty dies, to rapturous applause sort of thing, But, there's something fascinating there as well about it. So these are stories that I think that, shape us as we are growing up. And even, as you were saying before, that fully realized world, that enchantment. We talked about start of our podcast about Tolkien's On Fairy Tales, where he talks about fairy tales as a form of sub-creator, that we are sub-creators participating in creative endeavors. And he says, when we enter into fairy tales, he calls it the perilous realm, the shadowy marches, where magic is taken as serious truth, right? So these things that tell us allegorically something true about ourselves. So I'm the same as you. I grew up with it. I had all the, we had all the figurines, some of them original, some of them the paint chipped off them, and then we repainted them, not realizing how catastrophic that would be for our future, for our future income stream if we so desired that. I lost my brother's Boba Fett in a supermarket, and to this day he hasn't forgiven me. He's still, he'll point out how much that Boba Fett would be worth in today's dollar values.
One thing that I used to do as a kid, so because there was the I think in the mid to late 90s maybe, there was the re-release of all, like they started re-merchandising Star Wars, so the new action figures came out, which is amazing. But before that, when I was a very young child, my aunt used to take us to Birkenhead shops to go to a hobby shop to buy secondhand Star Wars toys. Thinking back, that's such a strange thing that I was doing. We'd be taken on the weekends to a hobby shop to buy used toys.
This is probably, we have to recognize there as well that, this is a set of movies that is a hypersyncretistic sort of appeal to it, right? It draws from different narratives, different faith traditions, different this to create this melange in ways, and it's pure postmodern religion in some ways, because it's sort of syncretized faiths meets consumerism, right? So it's a heavily marketed thing. So we were just, you know, we were the kids who bought
into buying products. And that's one of the defining features of it.
For the purposes of transcendence.
So one of the defining,
you know, we transcended
ourselves. One of the most important things about Star Wars from a cultural point of view is it was the first franchise that did this, that mass marketed, like that marketed its merchandise and brought the merchandise to the center of the cultural artifact. Nothing like that.
Fascinating.
Was because Lucas was very clever in that he took less money from the film, from the studio, but made a clause that he retained all the merchandising rights. And that wasn't a thing at the time.
Right.
And that's how he made his literal billions of dollars, was from retaining the rights to merchandising and then creating a new industry.
So it's fascinating as a just a side note, as a legal point as well, because it's often Jediism or Jedi is often appealed to as the case that is not religious. And when you've got cases to do with religious non-discrimination or religious liberty, and we're trying to define what religion is, people say, you know, it's various things, it's this, but it wouldn't include, say, being a Jedi, which is just not serious. So you get these, you know, on the census, people want to tick Jedi and so on, which fascinating, because actually if you look at how we understand religion in a contemporary consumerist society, Jediism is in ways pure postmodern religion. It is the pastiching together of various narratives in order to create an experience of transcendence through film, through consumption, through new social networks
well.
And things like this. Right. So, you know, fully realizing that we were, you know, basically indoctrinated into this new cult, there's something, even across the first six films, right, there's something about Lucas being able to have, you know, he understood, you know, that there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end. And what you do have, say, in the first three, A New Hope, Empire, Return of the Jedi, you have victory, then defeat, and then into victory again, or a hopeffulness that returns, you know, and there's a story arc that goes with it. Now, then we get to these more recent three films where we had... Force Awakens, which is kind of like, in the end, you have to now think about it as a fanboy's rendition of A New Hope. And then we've got Last Jedi, which seems to say, as a standalone film, is quite excellent, right? As a standalone film that probably threw a spanner in the works for Disney. And then they didn't follow through, because when we get to Rise of Skywalker, which is just bad. Yes. And I wanted us to now move to a quick-fire rant listing off the things we thought were bad in Rise of Skywalker. So, go.
So, the first thing that comes to mind was, at the end, this whole new fleet of Star Destroyers turns up out of nowhere, and they're all Star Destroyers.
They're all planet destroyers. They're all Death Stars.
Which is something that happened in the expanded universe, was that the only concept that the writers had of how to move a plot along was like just make the threat at the end of the whole thing infinitely bigger than ever before, which kind of...
And they just appear out of nowhere.
So there was...
They're just suddenly there.
I sent you that tweet, right from Elijah Wood, where someone... There was a Star Wars facts tweet that was like, did you know that the army and the starships from that the Emperor was using were constructed by this cult and things like that? And Elijah Wood replied going, no, how would we possibly know that?
you didn't tell us. You did not tell us this. So there's that. Then there's the fact that the Emperor comes back at all, right? And it's fine if they'd plotted this, but it's like the entire narrative is packed into the opening scroll. Oh, by the way, the Emperor's back. Cool.
Let's say Emperor.
That's right. So that's the next thing. Okay, your turn.
Oh, that Rey is a Palpatine, and yeah, I think that whole thing that completely undermines the whole you're actually no one, which was the moral lesson of the second film, was it doesn't matter where you come from,
Okay. I'm more okay with that because I see that there's the family dramas, but I understand. So,
but you already have Ben.
I would say
you already have Ben. Like that's the family connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. My next one would be how they turned Poe and Finn into machismo bros.
Yeah. So that basically, I think there was a note on every page of the script that they were on that just said no homo. That
yeah, and more shouting.
Yeah. So because there was, you know, there was a huge push in the fan community to basically make Finn and Poe get together. And that like squeezing in a reference to Poe's heterosexuality at every point in the film that was one.
And not just explicitly by creating a new character who's got this, who knows what her backstory is, but apparently it's got something to do with Poe, right? So new characters simply created for the sake of saying that this man is a fully red-blooded heterosexual, right? And then, and adding to that by making that every scene, basically the two guys, they just shout and they shout at each other. And it's like they're playing off like who's the real Han Solo sort of stuff. And that's all they do. That's their entire narrative device for the movie.
The other thing was I really liked Poe in the first two films. I thought that he's an interesting inclusion.
There was a moral progression that seemed to be taking place, right? Or moral development.
To not be such a douchebag. But he was also a different type of character. So he was less of a Han Solo, more of a kind of hotshot pilot type of archetype. But in this film, they were like, oh, turns out he's Han Solo. And so he had a smuggler background and all sorts of things. One of the worst things from a filmmaking point of view, as well as a narrative point of view, the fake out with Chewbacca's death, it made absolutely no sense. Like it just, it was.
But half of this would make no sense. I mean, it was just vignettes. So it was stapled together,
devoid of all logic. So you see the ship explode, and then it turns out that just behind them, while they were looking at that ship explode, there was another one taking
off. There's another going. Yeah.
And that was clearly
there's bits like that make no sense, right? Finding a knife that's a compass that exactly pinpoints where the Death Star would be in this raging water.
Which gets us to the problem, right? I think of. The Rise of Skywalker as a Star Wars film made by artificial intelligence. So the algorithm knew at that point we needed some sort of emotional beat at that point in the matter. It doesn't matter how it got there. They just needed something. So,
and you can see this, and if you contrast it with Return of the Jedi, how many planets do they visit in Return of the Jedi? Like maybe three. Whereas in this, in the first 10 minutes, they're at like 20 planets. They're just like jumping from planet to planet doing, you know, as though it's like that's, oh gosh, just this pure chaos as though they're trying to jam everything into this, you know, hyper-fueled adrenaline injection that just has makes no narrative sense.
Yeah.
What else? I've got here, the fact that she finishes with, I'm Rey Skywalker. Oh gosh, just like, what's the point? like it's just, you know, I saw a great tweet on this where it was like, and then Rey looks up at the camera and says, I'm Rey Star Wars.
And that was the best war in the stars that we've ever had.
That's right. And then what else? There's also Rose Tycho, right? They introduced this character in the second film, The Last Jedi. Fanboys didn't like her, I guess. And so she just becomes nothing to the point that Finn at one point at the end, she's like, Finn, you've got to come with me. And he's like, no, Rose, go away. And she's like, okay. It just sort of wanders off the screen. It's kind of like what George Lucas did to Jar Jar Binks in Attack of the Clones, right? Jar Jar walks on and goes, hi, Anakin. Anakin's like, hey, Jar Jar, bye. Yeah. That's all you see of him sort of thing, right? Like total notion of like, you have to be responsive to the worst inclinations of your fan base.
I mean, I feel like the writing credit should have gone to the focus groups, right?
Yeah, that's right.
One of the worst ones.
Or to whatever princess or to whatever Carrie Fisher had recorded on her phone prior to the movie. I mean, shoehorning her in there
was awful.
The dialogue was just so terrible.
It's like what's the dog character that Homer Simpson plays?
Poochie.
It's like, I'm going to my planet. Home planet now.
do, 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 do.
my final pet peeve before we move on is not pet peeve, horrible narrative thing in it, was just how like the emperor being destroyed through some sort of power that's associated with the love, but the convergence in the force between them. That's not so. When that stuff happens, you need to kind of indicate that that is part of the universe.
That's right. That's right. It needs to be part there. I mean, look, there were some good little bits, right? I quite liked it. If they'd actually built towards that as a narrative, built towards the Emperor there.
Of Rey, Kylo and Rey, that's
Red
great.
Is great.
And I actually, and like his conversion scene, I actually really liked. Some people do.
Yeah. And I like the two of them together and the way they come together like that. But if it had built towards that, fine. Without all the, you know, every ship is a Death Star. Just anyway, so these are just they're I'm sure we could go on. Even the music is just nothing. So substandard. Yeah. Just who cares? There is no lift.
Yeah, whereas
to
the previous two films, I really like the new additions to the score. Yeah.
That's enough ranting, I think, about all the various things we could go into. I wanted to just dig deeper down into a couple of points that I think this highlights, this why the film went awry and what that means and so on. So one thing it made me think of is how much I miss George Lucas, right? So I went to when I was at university doing an English Lit degree, it was all talking about reader response theory, right? How responses to text are grounded in the situation of the reader. And so the author loses agency. The author is dead, or the author is not present, or the author has no control over the text and so on. And, you know, there's some truth to that. Like, I got really annoyed when after she finished Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling started interpreting it for readers, right? And it's like, no, actually, you don't have complete control over your products. You know, there are communities that now get that interpreted over time and so on, right? But this, you know, with Rise of Skywalker made me realize a narrator, someone who has agency and intention, who takes us in a movement towards a destination, is actually something we might desire sometimes, right?
Yeah. I mean, just parenthetically, that's a really important point about postmodern theory, right? This stuff that starts off as a critique of power, so that, you know, the author loses their authority and it democratizes the reading, so that all that matters is kind of reader response. That ends up, what that turns into is production of film through focus groups. And so it ends up just serving consumerism and capitalism. Right. And similar things can be said of all sorts of different critiques of power. So these postmodern approaches to power, revealing everything is a power game, ends up just being commodified and incorporated within the capitalist system.
Yeah, and in this case, who was in charge? Like who took point. You know, there's something about the Marvel universe where you have like Kevin Feige has sort of got this kind of uber oversight of things, right? Whereas in this case, you had J.J. Abrams coming back for the third. And there does not seem to be any sense in which they'd plotted out these three movies and their integration with the previous six. So say all you like about the prequels, you know, episode 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating dynamic now that I think people have seen how bad Rise of Skywalker was, that now they're re-seeing the prequels in a better light, right? Because they do at least have narrative to them, like a narrative arc that integrates.
Well, the end point is fixed for those.
Right.
So that makes things easier.
Yeah. Yeah, but like, you know, surely if you wanted to start a new chapter in the story, you sit out and you plan it out, right?
Well, there's economic forces behind that, because Disney had just spent, what was it? It was at least $1 billion, $4 billion on the franchise. So they just made this huge investment and they were so keen to get an immediate return on it that they didn't bother spending time to actually craft a narrative. I think they just threw this out, and this was especially the case with the third one. They didn't want to waste time on something as trivial as thinking about the plot.
What does it mean that you finish the last film,
whereas the last
film before you was entirely about how expectations are defeated when you lionize and turn into a hero, this figure of Luke Skywalker. He becomes a sort of figure of defeated expectation who then has this moment of last hurrah, And then what happens in this film with Luke Skywalker, she goes back to the planet. He's all like, hey, how's it going? And he tells her this bizarre story about how him and Leia were training and she put her saber aside because she knew that. Makes no sense in the context of how we treated Luke Skywalker in Last Jedi, which lots of fans really disliked, of course, but it was interesting. It was fascinating. It was difficult to watch, but it was also like narratively interesting. And then that's just all discarded. There's no, so it makes me think, you know, about, you know, you got the Marvel Universe, you've got other films, like Christopher Nolan films have their sort of narrative imprint, right? They're clearly Christopher Nolan's films. You've got, you know, books that you love, you know, so you're reading the Rainwild Chronicles and then Fitz and the Fool and so on by Robin Hobb, right? Robin Hobb, you know, there is a sense in which there is a narrative order that is generated perhaps through a sense of agency, intention, person that is actually taking you on a story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so whereas this became, there was no coherent whole to these films. They all, each of them basically felt like, I don't know, in hindsight, they all feel like a mess, even though I think the first two were good. The ending of it robs the two other films of coherence because none of the things set up as narrative points came to fruition.
Right. So this is the second point, right? I think, you know, got the sense of agency and an actual narrator. You know, so George Lucas gave over his baby to a machine and the machine spat it out with algorithms and here you go. This is what you get, you know? You know, sort of thing that Dave would love because apparently he loves films that just have guns and people shooting and just, you know, that's all he's in for. But, you know, it's not cerebral, as Dave was saying at the beginning, right? Now, but then that's the second point that you're raising there, how the end, and if the end is a bit shit, how that can color the entire narrative, right?
Yes.
So, you know, you could think about how we talked about with Avengers Endgame, how it's the most eucatastrophic ending you can imagine in which, you know, defeat is overturned in a moment of shared joy, right? And the narrative arcs of these characters come to a satisfying resolution in which we have kind of like an epistemophilia, you know, the desire to know, the desire for a fruition, the desire for a fulfillment of something that comes to be, or that comes to be based on the narrative that we've seen. And in this film, you could say there is something eucatastrophic, right? All the ships are a Death Star. Ah, you know, and then there's this overturning. But it's kind of like the ending of this film. What happens is there's this kind of weak tilting of the hat towards a populism, right? That really just feels more like a deus ex machina. You know, it's all the ships from apparently the entire universe come to fight the Death Star ships. Yep. Makes no sense narratively.
And so there's something you could have done there, right? So one of the reasons that particular thing destroys the other narrative is, well, why didn't that happen during the years of oppression beforehand? And you could make a point out of that saying, once this now liberated people have gained from their political oppression and understanding their own responsibility, and so that's why the universe mobilizes against this new threat spontaneously.
Yeah, maybe.
But none of that work is done.
No, because most of the work in the films is about how a concerted effort by a rebellious few can disrupt disorder, can disrupt tyranny. Yes. And suddenly you get this, no, it's just masses of ships versus masses of ships. So there's something about the specific ending here where it's
and Last Jedi, which I think the most interesting, one of the most interesting kind of conceptual or thematic elements of the Last Jedi was that it was a resistance against thoughtless action and a lack of reflection and you know, using our words and thinking and things like that. That was what was being pushed by, you know, Leia, and that's the lesson that Poe had to learn And then that lesson gets overturned.
Right. So there's a specific point about the specific ending in this film and how it's problematic. But then the deeper point that you're raising is about how the last film, because it is the end structures the narrative of what's come before. So we can think about this as a matter of metaphysics, right? Like Aquinas talks about what is the first principle of practical reason, that is good is to be done and pursued. We must pursue the good. Follows, he said, after an understanding of man's last end. And man's last end, of course, Aquinas affirms, is God, which he says is the master of a person's affections. Since we take from this end of God, we take from this the rule for our entire life, right? So there's an idea here that the structure of the ending itself, orders our affections and orders the plots our narrative. So what is our end plots our narrative. Because, you know, it gives meaning to the various actions that have come beforehand.
Yes. So one of the Greeks, I can't remember who, said that a man's life can only be considered happy once he is dead, which people, I can't remember who said that. Anyway, someone please tell me on Facebook or Twitter. But that sounds like a very cynical attitude. So you can only be said that you're happy when you're dead. But what I take that to mean, and what I understand is the meaning behind it, is that happiness is a judgment that is made looking backwards. And so it's only at the end can you then judge what's come beforehand. And so a happy life or a good life is a judgment of a narrative. And I think that's what is happening in these films. So I think of this in terms of a good example of this is the Aliens franchise. So I really liked Aliens, the movies growing up, Alien, and then Aliens was really fantastic. And then the third Aliens movie came out, which was Alien 3. And the Aliens, the second film, was one of my favorite films of growing up and still is. I love it so much. But by the end of that three, and this is a spoiler, you have three survivors or four survivors. You have an android called Bishop. You have the protagonist of the film, the heroine of the film, Ripley, and one Marine called Hicks, and a little girl that they save. And that's a fantastic narrative arc. So it turns out that Ripley lost a child because she was in suspended animation for 60 years. And while she was frozen, her child died of old age. And her narrative arc is that she becomes a mother again through rescuing someone, and she forms a relationship with this Marine, Hicks. And so it's a classic narrative arc. It's the restoration of the familial life, the domicile. And you see this in the Odyssey in Homer. It's you go through this drama and you end up with the restoration of familial normality. But then the third film comes out, and it turns out that Hicks and the girl die off screen.
That's right.
Which actually robs the entire... It's not just a disappointment. The meaning of that film has evaporated.
Yeah.
The previous film has evaporated, and actually the previous two films.
Yeah, and you get...
And I think a similar thing happens. Oh, you get much
of that happens in this. So, you know, Finn has a moment of potential romantic intrigue with Rose Tycho, right?
Yeah.
Nothing happens. Any resolution between him and Ray, nothing. You know, various things that just sort of fall by the wayside or whatever. But that's a, you know, your example is a great one. It's sort of, you know, complete and utter disregard for narrative integrity, right? And here, I think it's both that, you know, the idea that you can judge something as good at the end, but also that the end gives narrative meaning to what's come before, right? So, we can interpret all the narrative plots in anticipation of that end. You know, the significance of the plot is given by our ending. So for Aquinas, again, you know, our ending is in God. And so the significance of our actions is judged in light of that narrative, right? Here, now, you know, this is, I mean, hilarious. We're taking this into the context of Star Wars, but like, what does it mean now? Like you said before, retrospectively now, I feel like I don't care to watch these films because it all leads up to this where Rey puts lightsabers in the sand and buries them. And I'm thinking, why? I don't know. There's no reason.
Yeah.
It bears no relationship to anything.
Yeah. And I suppose to bring it back to theology, this is what we mean by eschatology. So it is the idea that there is a sense of ending to creation. I don't mean things coming to being finished, but a sense of completion, that things are moving towards a goal. And I was reminded, so I think on Twitter this week, Steven Pinker, the Enlightenment fanboy,
yep.
He tweeted something about the people that are kind of social distancing skeptics in America. And he pointed to them as an example of why the idea of an afterlife is inherently poisonous because it robs life of its meaning. And that might be true for certain fundamentalists, right? The idea is that it's all about escape. But the idea of eschatology, rightly understood, is that the sense that things are transitioning into a new form of creation doesn't rob the present of its meaning and its value. It actually is the way in which we understand and give meaning and value to the present now. And so it's the understanding that that creation has an ending. I don't mean going into extinction. I mean it coming to its purpose. Mm. That's what that should actually motivate and give shape and give form to an understanding to the present moment.
That's right.
And I can't believe we've managed to get to this level of theology from Star Wars, but nonetheless, it's an important point.
Yeah, and you could, as a good narrative, I think, if you want to highlight that by contrast. So you could have, for example, a narrative could have been that after Last Jedi, things just got worse and worse, right?
Yeah.
There was a deepening despair and darkness, right? And then, you know, maybe you have hints of hope, but actually maybe they're extinguished, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But actually you could continue that narrative, and that would be a kind of like despair that points to, you know, our real desire for hope, right?
Because
in a negative manner.
Yeah, so that's what Tolkien does, right? So Tolkien, who gives us the term eucatastrophe, Lord of the Rings isn't an unambiguous, we all live happily ever after narrative. So what happens is the king is restored, but there's an understanding that this will decline. The elves fade away and go to the undying land and leave the world. Frodo himself is unrepairably damaged through his experiences and has to leave and can't enjoy the fruit of his labor. And the story itself is a tragedy, and a lot of people report after finishing it feeling this deep melancholy because it is based on this Norse or Germanic understanding of the cosmos. But that in itself awakens this desire for a true end to us. And so I think you're absolutely right about that. And actually, I didn't realize this, but there was a planned sequel to The Lord of the Rings that exists in note form Tolkien's notes. And it's set in the future after The Lord of the Rings, like generations after. And Gondor falls prey to basically a satanic cult.
Oh.
And humanity just becomes corrupt.
Yeah, right.
But again, and that doesn't, That is meant to awaken in us this sense that we want the world to be put right. Mm. Mm. And so it awakens in us what we'd call an eschatological learning.
I mean, look, let's just hope that the Mandalorian it's basically so much pressure upon it now. Or as one of our friends and producers, Tim, says, the Mandarin. What was it? The mandolin. Good Lord. It's almost as bad as you with your hatred of Star Trek. Get right in the heart, Dave. Just as a byline with a Star Trek point, there is a question about why does the world want to ruin all good things at the moment? So Star Wars ruined. If you watch Picard, gosh, that's a mess. It's an utter mess. Mm. It's just, and I think J.J. Abrams has a lot to say, a lot to blame there as well, but a lot of the blame to share. But anyway.
We're probably out of time. Thanks so much for listening to us. Probably get peak nerd for us. There's going to be a lot of people that'll be upset by this episode. But hopefully we got enough.
Do you mean upset we did it or upset Because of our views.
Upset that we did.
Okay.
But hopefully we smuggled in enough metaphysics.
We'll get back to other things in another time. We're actually just so you know as well, we're taking a month off because June is frenetic and too busy and so on. So we're gonna take that month off in the middle of the year and come back for things in July.
Yep. So we'll have I think it'll be our third season of The Eucatastrophe. Thanks so much for joining us. Please like us on Facebook. You can find us by just searching The Eucatastrophe. Follow us on Twitter. It's at UCAT, EUCAT _ podcast. Please review us, like us, share us around. That would be fantastic. And we will talk to you again after our little hiatus. See you then. Bye.